You'll miss it. Okay. So, yesterday we saw a few nafkemina of these different models that we presented. And we said today we would try to flesh out the rest of the implications of these different, these models for the exemption of the Talmud Chacham. Hopefully we'll finish it today, in which case we'll move to the Rabbi Yonatan ben Amram story tomorrow. Otherwise, push that by one day. We'll figure it out. Part of that depends on you guys, because I know that each nafkamina you guys like exploring at length, which is great, in which case I'm not rushed. I'm not like, okay. So what we noted yesterday was, again, remember we have three working models to explain the exemption of Talmidei Chachamim. One is simply the need-based model, that taxes that they're paying are simply, they pay for what they need, they don't need security, they don't pay, that's it. That was one model. Second model is kavod. Right? It's not respectful to impose certain obligations on them, so we don't. The third model was they already contribute to society, and therefore certain things they don't have to contribute in monetary ways or in service ways. Those were three models. And then we noted that it is possible that these models are not simply independently functioning rationales, but the point is that it could be that it's the combination of these factors that creates a cast of Talmidei Chachamim that leads to this exemption from taxes. Okay, that's where we left it yesterday, and it explored those models and the hybrid models through some of the nafkemina. But it's always fun to me. Mostly I put like our Shir Yomi online for like, you know, when people aren't here and it's just there, it's easier for me to put on YU Torah. And like some of the other shirim I give, people online listen. But for some reason, this topic has garnered interest. And I've already gotten two emails this week with like questions about the exemption of Talmidei Chachamim, which I have to actually get back to. One is my twice successor in Toronto, who emailed me because he's giving a shir on it. And then someone else from Toronto who follows a lot of my shirim, and we always have, he often emails follow-up questions and on it. If you're listening, I will get back to you. I just was busy last night and did not have time to answer all the good questions. Yeah.
Right,
potentially. And we're going to touch on it when I talk about the attempts at applying this Gemara to army service, right? I sort of planted the seeds, but we have to talk about it explicitly. Okay. So let's flesh out some of the nafkemina. So I gave you one very fascinating shuva by the Radvaz. So first of all, who is the Radvaz? New biography. We haven't done this in a little bit, but who is the... 1400s. 1400s to 1500s. Where does he live? Egypt. He is in Egypt. Very, very important. Post-Egypt, as things go, he writes 5,000 tshuvot, something like that. Many, many tshuvot. Very, very important. Post-Egypt. Reb David Ibn Zimra. Right? Reb David Ben Zimra. What? Yes. Right, meaning Radvaz stands for David ben Zimra, but it's actually David ibn Zimra. Zimra. Yes, he is from Egypt. What? Yeah. Meaning his main functioning as rabbi, he's known as an Egyptian rabbi. The Rambam is also born in Spain and moves to and is known for his time in Spain and no, sorry, his time in Egypt, not his time in Spain. What? Who, the Rambam? Oh, they both did. The Rambam got chased. None of them, like, willingly immigrated, right? The Rambam was expelled by Almohads, and or chased out by the Almohads, whatever. Almohads. That was the Rambam? No, I'm saying the Rambam was in Spain, chased out by the Almohads. No, Rav David Ibn Zibra is in the 15th century. No. Okay, so he has this fascinating question in that happened in Yerushalayim, okay? I forget if he actually makes it to Israel or just his Talmidim make it to Israel at some point. He's like the generation before the Beit Yosef. So like, okay? So here was the fight. It was a fight between the Balabatim and the Chachamim in terms of taxes. What does the Radbaz say? Radbaz has this fascinating case. The Balabatim say they don't need security. The rabbis say they do need security. Bikitsur, what is his main argument? They say they need it, and they have to pay for it. So, Toch G'day, what is the Radbaz? Which of the models does the Radbaz clearly take as primary, if not exclusive? The need-based one, right? The need-based one. And therefore, he says, and therefore, if you say you need it, that's it. Right? That's it. He says, it's true. If the rabbis need it, but the Balabatim also need it. So maybe there's some other model we can talk about it. But fundamentally, he says about need. And therefore, if the rabbis admit that they need it, that's it. They have to pay. Right? Now, interestingly, though, he could have said, but the Balabatim don't have to. He doesn't say that. Right? Now, is that because he thinks that there's a double model going on here? Right? Namely, that you need, it's the need base plus the Kavotam Yechamim, so they may not need it, but they're not in the other caste. Or what it sounds like more likely is that he doesn't really believe that the Balabatim don't need security. Right? Meaning, he admits that the primary needs are the rabbis, but he says, once they're there, it's dangerous. And everyone is really benefiting, and therefore I just say everybody has to pay. I think that's more what he's saying. Tokide, he also swallows that he thinks there's a very high bar of Talmud Chacham, and therefore he thinks this whole conversation is irrelevant, but he didn't need that. He didn't want to get into a fight with rabbis for no reason. I really, really, just in parentheses, you should know, tshuvot are a lot more fun than anything else, because life is always crazier than anything you can come up with. Always, right? So that's part of why I love reading Tshuvot. And yes, the Radbaz is just one of those people who, he's just wonderful. He's just wonderful. He has some of my favorite Tshuvot. And you find really weird things in the Radbaz, partially because he wrote like 5,000 Tshuvot, you know. Like he has wonderful Tshuvot about, you know, like one guy who got angry, so declared Nezirut Shimshon, which was Nezirut Shimshon, like a Nazir forever, like Shimshon. And the entire tshuva is just the Radbaz saying that at some point I asked the guy, why would you do that? And he said, because that's what people do. And he said, wait a second, do you have any idea who Shimshon is? Like, have you read Tanakh? And I said, no, I have no idea what a Shimshon is. He's like, I was Matir because he's an idiot. Right? That's it. Like, that's the entire tshuva. Like, you know. Or I mentioned to one of my friends recently, we were just talking about Tshuvot. And for some of you, we were talking about Tshuvot in the Radbaz. And I'm like, yes, you have this amazing Tshuvot in the Radbaz about Kilayim, right? Where someone asked him whether hemp is Kilayim, right? Because it sort of looks like cotton. So he goes to his whole Tshuvot. And then the end, and he's like, and I heard there are people, hemp is what? Marijuana is made up. So at the end of it, he's like, and I heard there are some people who smoke this in Egypt and it makes them happy. That's it. That is like the end of the tshuva. And you're like, what have you done? Like, there's no other, he doesn't weigh in more than that. It's just a very bizarre line. But Boss has a lot of fun things in this tshuva. Whatever. Yeah, Yaakov. Very good, very good. So you could have said, right, correct. So you could have said, and it sounded like what the people were arguing there was, we need protection, but we don't have to pay because the real motivation is something else, right? Kavod Tamid Yechamim. And the Radbaz rejects it because he very clearly takes the need-based logic here. Okay? But clearly what the other people are thinking is, no, I need security, but maybe there's another reason why I'm exempt. Right? The Radbaz rejects it. Right? That's the Radbaz's conclusion. Okay. I thought that was a fun Nafka Mina, which is why I wanted to share it, and just a fun tshuva in general. I love the Radbaz. I really do. Okay. So we had focused on three models, but admittedly there was a third and a half model that Andrew was partial to, which was that the real reason we exempt them is because we don't, is, and Yonatan was also partial to this, was this notion of time is money, we value Talmidei Chachamim's time learning Torah, we don't want to take away their time, and that's really what's going on here, right? The only person who I've found who really seems to go in that direction really explicitly is Amar Shah. Because, so if you look at the Amar Shah, Amar Shah is commenting on an earlier line in the Gemara, where the Gemara had said, Hein tu kuli raglecha, right? These are the tamichim shemechatetin raglehem, that they are, these are the ones that crush their feet walking city from city to learn Torah. Yeah. Oh, hold the rush. Hold the rush. The rush might. I want to show you an extreme version of it, and then we'll get to the rush. Okay? So the... What does the Maharsha say? How does he understand that line of Mechatzatin Raglehen, that they walk, that they grind up their feet walking town, city to city to teach Torah? What does he understand? So what does he say? Rasa lomar dimen adinim turim Mimisim, the mighty dam, gonna be ear, view ansha ear. No, I'm sorry. Marsha doesn't say this, right? Marsha makes a different argument. It's the Rush that makes this argument. What is Marsha's argument? Marsha makes a totally different argument, and that is the problem is simply that these taxes are all predicated on being part of the city. And the assumption is how many come are always traveling. Right, and therefore they never settle down. And it's only those types of Tamid Chachamim who are wandering scholars that are exempt. And it's a totally different story. It's just that Tamid Chacham is not chayv in any given city's taxes because he's a right nomad.
And you can get it during the hand of God.
Yeah, or something like that. Right. Now the rush deals with the question of right Andrew's question, which is. Okay, we've talked about Talmud Chacham, but what is a Talmud Chacham for these purposes? So what does the Rush say? Yeah?
He says that someone who they only spend the bare minimum time required to survive on working or doing business, and that's the entire time.
Right, very good. So the Rush says that the real focus here is not the status of Talmud Chacham in terms of knowledge, right? The real issue is it's a someone who right. It's because he's Toratan Umanotan, and therefore he says any Talmud Chacham either learns all day, or you know just works enough to scrape by, right, and then goes right back to learning. He's Pater. And what sounds like from the Rush is what Adam said: is that the real exemption here is because we don't expect them or want them to be giving up their time, right? But according to Rush, it sounds like it's not about their status as Talmud Chacham, right? The real issue is that, look, if I know that you learn 12 hours a day, that's great, that's mechubad, right? But then the way you relax is you watch 2 hours of Netflix every night, right? So that's fine. That might be totally respectable. But if in that 2 hours you could, you know, be a part-time programmer, right, or whatever, and put in and make enough money to pay for your basic food and for security, so then go do it. Right? From the Rush, it sounds like he's defining Talmud Chacham for these purposes as someone who's Torat Umanutan, not because that's the highest level Talmud Chacham. But because the real issue here is that we want to respect their time. So if, right, they work, or there was, I remember in Alon Shvut, there was a guy there who, he basically, his schedule was that he was a very talented programmer, so he had a deal with his company that each week he just worked the number of hours that he basically needed for money, and then he would learn the rest of the time. So someone like that, right, if literally you can see, right, he learned, you know, he needs to work 10 hours a week, so if you were to add the taxes in, then you'd have to work 12 hours a week. We don't want to do that, so we exempt him. Eventually, the guy gave up and became a professor of Torah. But for many years, he did this. Yeah.
With the Rush agree with that if the Rabbanim are, like, even that case, because if the Rabbanim are...
Very good. So I don't know, right? Meaning, it could be. Right? Could very well be. All I know is that the Rush, the way he frames Toratan Umanutan sounds to me like the direction he's taking is that it's really about respecting their time. Right? Now, you could say that that's really a subdivision of the time contribution issue from the Rambam. Right? That you're saying, if the real reason you're exempt is your contribution to society, so as long as all you do is learn and make enough money, oh, for God's sake. But if, wait, what happened? Oh no, did the recording just stop? Please tell me it didn't. No, it didn't. Okay, good. But if, right, now sometimes in halacha, the reason that we care about Toratan Amanotan is because that's the only real Talmud Chacham. It doesn't sound like that's what the Rush wants here, right? I think, right? Because the Rush is telling you that, right, because normally Toratan Umanotan really means you learn and do nothing else, because a full person who's Toratan Umanotan has no obligation to do mitzvot either. Like, he's pater from davening. Right, that's, and therefore, right, that's a very high standard. That doesn't seem to be what's going on here. Right, it sounds like what he really thinks is that, look, if somebody is only working, right, to scrape by, but really, really devoted to Torah, so then we don't want to take away the time. That is my guess as to what the Rush is going with. Yeah.
If you were to have a rabbi that, like, is terribly long running, and so they spent all of their time on it, but if they were to take taxes, that wouldn't come out of their time.
Good. So I don't know for the Rush. Right? For the Rush, I don't know. Right? I mean, he doesn't say explicitly there's an exception. I don't know if he has multiple models working here. Right? Right? Look, there are people like that, obviously, right? Those are always the most fun rabbis, because they're not answerable to anybody, so they can say whatever they want. No, seriously. You know. So you could, right? You could, right? My feeling is that he's framing it more about time, but you're right. It could be that this is only certain days. I mean, they come and deserve that covenant. When fleshing out la halacha, you should know that la halacha, in certain areas of halacha, we are have very high standards for what counts as Toratan Umanutan. The Rama paskins here like the Rush. It's not true here. That here we have a more expansive definition, either because of this time issue or because you say, look, to be putter for mitzvot, that's a very high standard. But here, to deserve kavod, right, even lower levels, I mean, the chachamim, I mean, look, let's be honest, right? By this standard, you know, like, the fact that, you know, Ray Ginsburg takes 6 weeks in the summer to go and be a dentist, right, and make a lot of his parnassah from being a dentist, right? So if you're just saying, you know, he's already choosing to take those, you know, months and whatever, so maybe you'd say, okay, he has to pay taxes, but I don't think that would diminish from his kavod, right? Dafka, right? The opposite. Right, but you could argue, look, you're schlepping out, you know, you're traveling, you're doing it, you know, you're working, whatever, right? You could argue, oh, well, now at least for the purpose of taxes, you have another source of, you know, income coming in. You know, we'd have to figure it out. And, you know, I don't want to sort of get into it, but you can see how this question, we don't require the highest level, right? It sounds like either we require a level where time-wise we can't really expect you to put in the extra time, or we just say, yeah, maybe as you're saying, kavod, look, any Talmud Chacham was anywhere near that level, right, deserves that type of honor. Okay. Good. I think that was everything I gave you inside, right? Good. So that means I have half an hour to finish this up, and tomorrow I'll give you something else. Very good. So there were a few outstanding questions that we had left in this sugya. Okay. One is the theological question, right? So far we've mostly talked about what justifies this, you know, the societal implications. But we said that one of the questions hanging over the sugya is the theological issue, which is, yeah, meaning, in the end of the day, this is not just that you're making a claim that God is going to protect you, and therefore you don't need to be protected. That, theologically speaking, besides for everything else, is really problematic. So the person who really seems to have taken this up is the Chazon Ish. Okay? If you're interested in the full theological piece, I found this very nice little article by Dr. Yaakov Altman, where he basically traces the Chazon Ish's theology throughout the Chazon Ish. in order to explain the Chazanish position here. Now, who's the Chazanish? Let's,
The
Chazanish lived in Israel in the middle of the 20th century. He is Avram Yeshaya, that's the Ish. Right? Chazanish is really, the Aleph Yud Shin is Avram Yeshaya. That's where he got the name, Chazanish. He is basically the father of Israeli Haredi Judaism. That's basically who he is. He's a very important person to understand, right? He is the person who basically negotiated the original deal with Ben-Gurion, getting the exemption of Kolel guys from the army, right? That is like his that's when he lives, okay? He's a fascinating personality. As much as he's the father of modern Haredi Judaism, in many ways he does not fit the model. So first of all, his major works are not really written in Lishna Derabanan. They're written in modern Hebrew, which is interesting. People don't even notice that, but it really is not written like rabbinic writing. It's written more in modern Hebrew. The Chazanish is one of those amazingly fearless poskim. His book is written, are divided by like Yoredeya, Evan Ezer, Arachayim, like written on the four Chalakim Shulchan Aruch, but they're not by Siman. Because he basically writes halachic essays, and he doesn't feel bound, like he'll argue on Rishonim. He's a very fascinating figure. He's really fascinating, Posek. If I remember correctly, he doesn't have kids. His heirs are more like people who married his in-laws, like Chaim Kanievsky, that somehow married into the family. I don't remember exactly how. So he comes up with the following case. What if you have a city of only Talmidei Chachamim? Nikuda. Only Talmidei Chachamim. What? Look, Talmid Chacham is not identical with Haredi in either direction. I understand. And maybe that's why he's thinking of it, because that is how people like talking about Bnei Brak, right? Fine. But, yeah. This characterization does not create so many friends outside of Bnei Brak, that's true. But anyways, yeah. Okay, very good. So let's go through the models. So, if you think it's just a need-based model, so then what would you say? So if you really think that they have divine protection, so then the answer would be? Nobody pays for it, and they don't need security, and that's the end of the story, right? But if you think that the real issue isn't that, the real issue is what? Is kavod. So then you might say, well, look, if there are balabatim who can support the Talmidei Chachamim, so then it's dishonorable to make them pay. But who's dishonoring the Talmidei Chachamim here? There's nobody here but rabbis, right? But Talmidei Chachamim. Rabbi is not, Haredi is not synonymous with Talmidei Chachamim, neither is rabbi, okay? I have critiques on certain institutions, which I won't say on record, right? Because I just don't think that they produce enough Talmidei Chachamim. Whatever. But someone once asked my wife, because she mentioned this, and he's like, well, is that fair? Does he have the same critiques on rabbis and ... And I was like, yeah, he rants about that all the time. I am equally critical of anybody who masquerades as Talmidei Chachamim who is not, right? I have high standards. So if you think it's kavod, so then you'd say, well, look, there's no lack of kavod. Everyone's a Talmidei Chacham, right? It's just there's no one else to pay. So the Chazon Ish takes the position that, in fact, let me read it to you. No, not this one. This one. Yep. Kazanish says, and now, well, you know, let me say it outside first, okay? So, as I understand the Chazon Ish, I think Altman is right here. The Chazon Ish believes the following. The Chazon Ish is not willing to accept the straightforward read of our Gemara that this is about need, right? It's a need-based exemption, because taking a strong need-based exemption would bind him to the theological claim that you should and can rely on miracles in this world. And that the Chazon Ish can't buy. So that theological problem leads the Chazon Ish to a different claim, which is the following. One second. Which is that really what's going on here is kavod, service, contribution, argument, right? Really what's going on here is something else. It's just that the reason that we choose to express our kavod to Talmidei Chachamim by exempting them from certain types of security taxes is because Torah protects you, but not in an absolute sense, right? Not an absolute sense. I mean, he's not willing to commit himself to the theology that if I do a mitzvah, I am automatically protected. What he's willing to do is to say this. In some metaphysical way, being a Talmud Chacham protects you. And therefore, if you combine that sort of vague notion with kavod, and there are other people there who need respect on Talmidei Chachamim, and therefore will build a wall, and therefore the Talmidei Chachamim don't need to only rely on the Nes, but they can rely on the fact that other people are putting up a wall. So the combination of the fact that the rabbis at some very abstract metaphysical level don't need security or need less security, combined with the fact that there are people in the city who are supposed to honor them by contributing on their behalf, then he's willing to say you don't have to contribute. But, let me just get his thesis out. But therefore, if that's the case, what would come out, if that's what you think it is? Right? That you theologically are not willing to accept the strong model. Right? And therefore you think that what's really going on is kavod. Right? And the Rabbanim Lo Tzricha in the Tiruta is like a secondary justification for why we express the honor in this particular way. So then, in a city which is fully made of Talmidei Chachamim, so then what will he say? You should build a wall. Right? Because now there's no one to honor you, and in order to not build the wall, you would have to commit yourself to the theological claim that you really don't need security, and you can rely on miracles. Now, you could see somebody saying that, but the Chazon Ish, consistent with his general theology, is very wary about relying on miracles, and therefore he ends up reading our sugya more about kavod, not because he wants kavod to come in, because he thinks that's more plausible. Because, right, it doesn't require you to this theological question. Let me just read it, and then I'll take your question, Ezra. He says, Yesh la'al yein. I have to understand this. You have to look into it. Halo gam rabbanan tzrichan lenhog min hagolam. Don't rabbis also have to live normal lives? V'lo lisroch halaneis? And not rely on miracles? And therefore, he says, v'efshar, and therefore it's possible, the be'ir dekulu rabbanan kofen zed zelivnot choma. That when it's all rabbis, they can force each other to build the wall. Aval, be'ir shedarin ba b'nei adam, v'yesh b'neihem rabbanan, matilin et achoma al hamona am. But when you have other people in the city, so then you put the taxes on the other people, u'potren et achachamim k'mo shepotrojim en amatz, k'mo shatar patertan. And then they exempt them themselves from the tax. Yes, Ezra.
Can you say that, when the community or whatever is entitled to not impose the tax on the rabbis or those in the law, they are showing to them by saying that, why I think your community with Torah is so great,
Exactly. Right. I mean, I think that's what he'll tell you, is that it's not that, like, you know, in the abstract, we believe Torah protects people. So we're not willing to rely on that by itself, because that's relying on miracles. But if you're already talking about taxes, and there's someone else to build the wall, and you're trying to figure out in what way should they show their honor, then it's the honor of the Torah for the other people in the city to show respect by not making you contribute. Right? It's a very attenuated claim here, right, which solves the theological problem. Now, this theological point, though, brings me to the last thing I really want to discuss on this. So, again, there's a lot we could talk about, but this is one of the other heated issues, which is, can you learn anything about our sugya to the exemption of Talmidei Chachamim, Torah learners, whatever, from the army? Okay? What? Right. So now let's spell it out theoretically. Okay? Let's start from where we just left off, from the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, what drives the Chazon Ish here is a theological claim, right? Which is that he's not willing to say that you can rely on miracles. Okay? Agreed? But Toch Kedei, he tells you something, which is that in the end of the day, this entire sugya is a very narrow sugya, meaning that everything we've been talking about only makes sense in the context of what? What? Of what? No. Of security what? Security? Taxes. That's it. I mean, what is hidden in the Chazon Ish's analysis? Is that the issue here is not really that rabbis don't need protection, because you can't say that, because that's a far-reaching theological statement. What is it? It's that the metaphysical abstract claim that Torah protects you is enough to say that when we're trying to set up a tax scheme where everybody contributes something, but there are certain exemptions built in for whatever reasons, that we can say that at some metaphysical level, Talmidei Chachamim don't require as much security, and therefore we should give them a clergy exemption for security, and that's the way that the community will show respect to them. But what is behind the Chazon Ish argument is that there is no far-reaching claim that Talmidei Chachamim don't need protection. It's that when we already start with the fact that because of honor, you should give some personage, essentially, to Talmidei Chachamim, the way that we should tight, right, the same way that in Canada, you get the way parsonage is expressed is a write-off on your house, right, on your rent. And I think that the logic is basically, I think, is that, you know, rabbis, priests, whatever, don't necessarily make as much money as the average person in their congregation in a very wealthy place, and therefore they may be paying more rent, right? Meaning a rabbi, look, if you're living in Toronto and the average tear down house is over $1 million, which it is, so the average salary of people in Toronto is, let's say, people are high paying lawyers and doctors and whatever, and making $250,000, whatever, you know, a year, I don't know, right? Right, I remember when I talked once to someone who was involved in one of the schools in Boston 10 years ago and said that the way finances work in Boston, you were eligible for financial aid at the school if you made less than $450,000 a year, right? Right, do you understand that? What? No, it was the Solomon Schechter. It was the Solomon Schechter, okay?
And then they happened to
what? The Schechter?
Which one? The one in Newton?
Newton. So like, right? In a reality like that, you know, not that I talk about my salary, but I promise you, Migdal is not paying me $450,000 a year, okay? I promise you that. So in such a reality, it makes sense to say, look, if you want somebody to live in a community where the expectations people are making, $500,000 is easy, and you're not intending on paying your rabbis $500,000 a year. So then it makes sense to say, well, they're still paying, you know, rent or mortgage on a house in a community that's meant for people who are making $500,000 a year. So we'll express parsonage by giving you a write-off on your house, right? That's a logic, right? You'll say, look, we're not going to let you write off your food bill because food is pachot yoter, the same price, right? Give or take in all these neighborhoods. But rent is much higher in these neighborhoods. And if you want rabbis and priests and imams and whatever to service people in high income neighborhoods, then you need to give them a break on real estate. Okay? That's basically how the Chazon Ish conceptualizes this exemption, which is we want to show respect in some way to the Talmidei Chachamim in our tax code. So how do we do that? So we say, well, if we're going to exempt them from a tax, which should it be? It's the one that at some metaphysical level they shouldn't need, right? Right, that's basically the logic of the Chazon Ish. But if that is the very limited logic of the Chazon Ish, then our entire sugya, Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta, is not meant to be a far-reaching claim. It's meant to be a justification. And the ones that have other reasons to exempt you from a certain part of the tax code, this is the one I'm going to grant you. Right? It's a very limited argument. If that's the case, does it make any sense to expand it to good? In order to make the claim that Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta is going to exempt Torah learners from the army, you need a much more radical theological claim here, right? Which is, first of all, that you don't need protection, bichlal, right? That's how you have to understand this line. And you have to assume that that what the Gemara is telling you is not a din in taxes, right? It's a claim that rabbis don't need security, and therefore anything going to security, they are just out, right? Now, that argument was actually made by Ramosha Feinstein. Ramosha is a very short tshuva where he says exactly that. The rabbi, that Talmidei Chachamim should be exempt from the army because Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta. What? For these purposes, he seems to have. Seems to. Now, there were other people like the Tzitzel Yezer who said, no. Talmidei Chachamim aren't exempt because Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta. They're pater because of a different model, which is the Rambam's model in Shmita of Yovel, which is they contribute to society because Torah protects society, and therefore they are already contributing, right? So you had Rav Moshe who invokes this sugya by Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta, but now you realize how radical of a claim that is. And Alterman points out that even though the Chazon Ish supported the exemption for kollel guys and yeshiva students, he did not justify it based on Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta. And Alterman says, why not? Because the Chazon Ish didn't buy that broad, sweeping theological claim. To say that they're exempt from the army because of Rabbanan lo tzrichin nitiruta would force you into that theological claim that he thought was illegitimate. Right? What the Chazon Ish can say is, I think it's important there are people who are learning in yeshiva. And therefore you should exempt from the army. That, buy it, take it or leave it, fits with the Chazon Ish's theology. But Rav Moshe's claim does not fit with the Chazon Ish's theology. Right? Now, I should point out that even if you don't like the yeshiva student exemption from the army, which I don't love it, to put it mildly, right? We should just note that the Chazon Ish, when the Chazon Ish said it, it was very different than now. Meaning, as many people have pointed out, the Chazon Ish was talking about this in 48, when, right, in like 1950, where the yeshivot had legitimately just been decimated in the Holocaust, and the number of people who were asking for this exemption was like a handful, right? So there, in the 1940s and 1950s, it was a bit more of a plausible argument to say, look, we need somebody to basically rebuild the Olam HaTorah, so people who are willing to do that, let them do it, right? And many people have pointed out that just because the Chazon Ish said this in 1948 doesn't mean that you can, right, say that Chazon Ish would say the same thing in 2020. Right? The Chazon Ish said it when he said it. Right? There are people who continue to make the argument, but you can't blame the Chazon Ish. Right? So I really don't have, like, any, you know, as much as I don't like the argument per se, I don't have a taina on the Chazon Ish so much. Even if I disagree, right? Ramosha's argument disturbs me a little bit more, because of the implications of it theologically and morally. Which brings me to my last point on this, which was, so many, yeah. I doubt it, right? I doubt anyone would say, you don't have to save a rabbi who's being chased by a rodev because his Torah will protect him, so you might as well, right? There has to be some limit. You're right. There has to be some limit to this theological limit. And that's honestly what bothers me about Ramosha's tshuva most, is that the Chazon Ish, for whatever you agree or disagree, he's going out of his way to not make that theological claim. And that's Alterman's point. Yeah, sure. Maybe that's what it is. Now, I will note, though, that many people, just to summarize this, and again, I don't want to get into it in just the last few minutes, I'll just flesh this out. Many people push back on Reb Moshe and the Chazon Ish for the reasons we just said, but they added more to it, right? Reb Zevin, in his article, and Reb Lichtenstein, in his celebrated article, Torat HaHesder, or the ideology of Hesder, right? Hesder Yeshivot, I assume you know, right? Yeshivot that have some years of learning and some years in the army, which was, right, you know, is a theological claim for... both make the following point, which is that... Now, I'm not pretending that I'm fleshing out this whole sugya, okay? There's a lot more to this sugya. But they both make the point that, like the Chazon Ish, that this is limited to taxes. But they go farther than that, and they say... You know why? For a few reasons. One of the reasons they believe, this is Reb Zevin's argument, one of the reasons that, and this comes back to Ezra's point 2 days ago, Reb Zevin says, you know why this halacha is only halacha in taxes? Because there's no mitzvah to build a security wall. It's just something you need. It's mundane. So there, you want to say to Tami the Chamam or Pater, fine. But to fight in the army to protect people, why are you doing that? Not only because you need protection, but because protecting other people actively is a mitzvah. The halachic and theological claim you need to say that a Talmud Chacham is putter from a mitzvah is a much, much more extreme claim than saying that this is a prat in how do we allocate personage exemptions, right? And therefore, Zevin says, I'm not willing to accept it here because this is a mitzvah. Furthermore, he says, and many people pointed out, wait a second, if Rabbanan lo tzrichin itiruta, so you're taking that as an exemption, but I can flip that on his head and say, wait a second. Torah protects. Who else do I want in the army but people who warrant that protection? Right? If you really believe in the theology behind it, then you're super soldiers, right? Exactly. So I'll just read you a little bit of Rav Lichtenstein's response to some of this, okay? And we'll finish with this. He says as follows. So he says that some people feel that the spiritual price, personal and communal, is simply too high, that first-rate Torah leadership can only be developed in the monochromatic context of pure yeshivot. Right? Still others contend that from the perspective of genuine faith and trust in God, the yeshivot are the true guardians of the polity. And any compromise in their integrity is a blow at national security, right? That's the Tzitzel-Yezer model. These contentions clearly raise a number of basic moral, halachic, and theological issues with respect to which I obviously entertain certain views. being the Rosh Yeshiva of the biggest Hezer Yeshiva in Israel, right? Okay. However, I do not wish at this juncture to polemicize. These are matters of which honest men of Torah can differ seriously out of mutual respect, etc. What I do wish to stress minimally, however, is the point that for the aspiring Talmid Chacham, Hezer is at least as legitimate a path as any other, and it is, to my mind, a good deal more, but surely not less. The point can be underscored by a brief glance at the relevant proof text most frequently cited by rigorous critics of Hezder. Of course, those who oppose it because they have little use for the state and presume that its dismemberment would not seriously endanger its inhabitants need not look far for support. Given their assumptions, they can draw upon a plethora of sources that stress the overriding importance of Talmud Torah and castigate the expenditure of time upon relatively insignificant purposes. I very much, however, that among our critics, this is a decidedly minority view. And I prefer to address myself to the position of those who do assign a measure of value to the state, and hence of necessity to its army, and whom the question of military service therefore confronts as an instance of a difficult, perhaps even agonizing choice between conflicting values. So then he skipped down. He says, while most of the relevant texts are halachic, one locus classicus is purely halachic, and it may best be treated first. The Gemara in Bava Batra states that Talmidei Chachamim are exempt from sharing the cost of municipal fortifications inasmuch as they do not require protection. Analogously, it is contended that they should be exempted from military service, i.e. Rav Moshe Feinstein. One may state in reply that this claim raises a very serious moral issue. Can anyone whose life is not otherwise patterned after this degree of trust and bitachon argue for exemption on this ground? Is it possible to worry about one's economic future in evident disregard of Rabbi Eliezer's statement that whoever has bread in his basket and says, what shall I eat tomorrow, is but little faith, and still not enter the army because one is presumably safe without it? Right? So his first argument is which argument? The Radbaz. Right? Which is, if you think you don't need it, then you'd better live a life that shows that you totally live on bitachon. If you don't, then you admit that you need basic human needs and you're not relying on Torah, so your need argument goes out the window. Right? Critique one. He says, I recall some years back admiring the candor of a Magid Shir who confided in me that he had moved from a neighborhood in which most young men serve in Sahal to one in which they did not. Because he might be convinced intellectually that he ought not to serve in the army, he knew full well that he did not possess the depth of faith upon which such an exemption could be granted. He felt too ashamed, especially as his sons were coming at a military age, to remain in his old bailiwick. Perhaps not many would share this response, but the basic situation is probably not uncommon, and for many, at least, any argument based on this Gemara is consequentially problematic. Furthermore, right, he says, there is, however, no need to pursue this train of thought, for the basic analogy is quite tenuous on purely halachic grounds. The payment in question is not inherently normative. It relates to no mitzvah whatsoever. Rather, it derives solely from the obligation to help defray the cost of communal facilities from which one reaps benefit. I mean, this is a local halacha. It's basically a question of how do you apply parsonage. This is obvious from context. The impost is discussed in the same Mishnah that deals with requiring tenants of a courtyard to pay for a gate or a watchman's booth, or both in order to keep out trespassers and onlookers. And both are cited by the Rambam and Hilchot Shechinah. Moreover, it's reflected in the fact that the sum is prorated according to the degree of benefit involved, right? Like we talked about, with those subject to the greatest risk paying the most. Hence, those who derive no direct benefit pay nothing. Tenants without cars do not generally pay for the upkeep of the building's garage. And those who have no television sense may be exempt from sharing in the cost of a central antenna. The situation is radically different, however, with respect to an obligation precisely rooted in the responsibility to help others qua others. Does anyone suppose that one's duty to engage in a defensive milchamet mitzvah to help save the people of Israel from a foe who descended upon them is based solely on the fact that one is presently or potentially in danger? In the context of the egocentric ethic of Mandeville, or an Adam Smith, possibly. From a Torah perspective, however, that's not fair, by the way, to Smith. That's fair to Smith in Wealth of Nations. It's not fair to Smith in Theory of Moral Sentiments, but I'm not getting to an argument with Avara now on Adam Smith. But okay. From a Torah perspective, however, this would be a strange doctrine, the more so to the extent that we correctly perceive that such action is mandated by the general norm of tamid, of gemilut chasadim, and not just the specific commandments of defensive war. Consequently, the Gemara in Bava Batra provides no rationale whatsoever for totally exempting tamid chum from military service. They may not require protection, but others do. And their duty to defend those who have built in armor remains. Right? So Rav Lichtenstein argues that this is halachically and theologically should be understood like the Chazon Ish, as limited to parsonage exemptions. But any far-reaching claim makes no sense theologically or morally when you're talking about an army where what's obligating you is not some tax law, but is a mitzvah. And there he says, Tamid and Chayim Bas, and I'll just note in his footnote, he notes, I'll just read you two footnotes quickly. I know I'm a little bit over time, but fine. One may ask just why the Mishnah did not classify payment for fortifications as aid. The question of who should pay for public services, the beneficiaries of the or the community or the whole community, is general and complex and certainly deserves treatment in its own right. However, the halacha's decision in this case is clear. In any event, what cannot infer from a situation in which the burden is cast upon residents who evidently can afford the facility to one in which, by the very nature of the mitzvah, is incumbent upon the general community. I take it for granted, although this is admittedly a rather murky criterion, that if the residents could not afford the fortifications, the others would have been taxed to pay for them, right? So he says, he just assumes, based on his argument, that were it be a case where they needed security, and the Tamidei Chachamim were the rich ones, and the Balabatim were poor, and someone needed to protect, Rav Aaron argues that he thinks Tamidei Chachamim would have to pay. Because he thinks that this is such a limited case, that it's just parsonage. He's saying, look, if the Gemara's implication is that, if the Tamidei Chachamim don't pay, the taxes in the community will be able to support what the community needs. So then you can talk about parsonage. But he goes farther on the need base, and he says, and therefore, if it were a case in which the Balabatim need Tamidei Chachamim to protect them, i.e. the Radbaz's case, that we would make them pay because you don't give people parsonage exemptions when the government can't afford it. Yeah. Good, so we're going to have to talk about tomorrow. That's why I said this is a good place to end, because tomorrow we're going to talk about that case, and that's what I want to deal with for all of tomorrow. I want to look at the Ritva. The Ritva is understood by the Beis Yosef, which is quoted in the Marashah, and the Kovetz Shurim. That's it. Three sheetot. Okay? Very, very simple. Now, he notes that there are some halacha that exempt Tamid Chachamim from other taxes. But again, he says this exemption is essentially similar to one widely granted religious interest only for the communities imposing upon them. He adds 2 points. He says, one, he thinks that this only says the community can't force them, but tells you nothing of whether Tamidei Chachamim should offer, right? And therefore, in this case, he thinks where there's a mitzvah involved, he thinks that Tamidei Chachamim should actively want to be to contribute. And the second point he notes is that it's even if you bought everything, it's very unclear that Kollel students count as the level of Talmud Chacham that is required for this exemption to begin with. Okay, so in a nutshell, that's a summary of some of the arguments that are made, but you see how the lumdus, the theological problem raised by the Chazon Ish, the moral issues that are raised by Rav Aaron and by Rav Zevin all sort of, right, play out together in this very major nafkamina, which is, do we believe that Kollel guys should end up in the army? Yeah. Okay. Ezra, Yonatan, I'm going to stop the recording so I can-